Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Midnight Hour in California, 2 o'clock Central Time. This is Jane Hoffman reporting live from the point of Lake Superior on the North Shore. I wanted to bring up 2 points. When John comes on the line, I'll bring up my second point about our rather hot discussion the other night about the remembrance of the Selma March. Tonight I wanted to share something. Believe it or not, now this is the first time for me, the 700 Club had better coverage of minor elements of the ISIS war than mainstream news. Now, I've been studying this on my own for quite a while. The Peshmerga, whose name translates as those who face death, they're Kurdish fighters that have been a firm coalition of well-organized fighters on the Kurdistan, northern Iraqi, Iranian, and Turkish border since the late 1800s. They were formally organized as a national fighting force of the Kurdish people after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in the wake of World War I. As the Kurdish national movement grew, so did the identity of the Peshmerga as part of the Kurdish culture, evolving from tribal defenders to national fighters and as an independent Kurdish state. Now, I'm not familiar with this, but I didn't know Iran or Iraq formally controlled Kurdistan. That's one country that evolved out of the Russian separation in 1989. The modern-day Peshmerga are mostly veterans from the fighting against Iraq forces. And most recently, that would have included the Gulf War in 1991. And they had to defend themselves in 2003 when Iraq dissolved into a Western-controlled state. Let's see if John's on the line yet. Nope. I'll have to text him briefly. The regional disarray left a power vacuum and Kurds... oh, here he is. The Kurds began vying for an independent state on their own. Now, lately they've been on their own for sure. There's been hardly any international support as the ISIS took hold of Tikrit and Mosul. Let's say hi to John, who just recently joined us. Good evening, John.
Oh, greetings, Mighty Hammer. And how are you? How is the frozen one today?
The frozen one thawed into 60-degree weather.
Oh, that's pretty good. Last time it was, what, 39 or so, 38?
It was 37 on Saturday, going into Sunday, and then it was 50 Monday and 60 today.
Wow. I don't think my brain functions until it's about in the 40s.
Well, 60 is the new 80.
I see. So tonight we're talking about...
I was in shorts today.
Tonight we're talking about Revenge of the Turds. I mean, the Kurds. The
Speaking of turds, Bob made a rather strong statement Sunday night, and I was wondering if you caught it.
Go for it.
He said something to the effect that not only do I dislike gays, I borderline hate them.
Oh, well, you know, I'm not sure about his past history. I think we all, now some of us have natural dislikes, and I think we've come to an age where people just can't have opinions anymore. I'll give you an example.
Well,
we're gonna
address this however long we want to.
Sure.
And I'm gonna let you talk for 5 minutes, but I'm just gonna make
Go
one
for
prelude.
It.
What we were talking about is the March on Selma,
right?
And how the gay rights kind of infiltrated that. Now my problem is if I have gay friends in my real life, which I do, mm-hmm. but not so much in Duluth. I only know one gay person.
Right.
Actually, I know two. One is a lesbian, and it's actually my relative. But basically, I don't really talk to gays face-to-face about their sexuality or Bible teachings unless they address me, but I don't really hate anybody. I was thinking I'm writing a story right now on David Koresh, like a 10-part series. I don't even hate people who are cult leaders or serial killers. I don't really hate anybody. The only people I really hate is people who hurt children. So go ahead with your comments.
Well, I was going to say, I think a lot of that depends on the person's history and experience, and that can alter things. I know some friends who grow up in neighborhoods where they just don't like blacks, or blacks, they don't like Mexicans. And it's very deep-seated, and a lot of it has to do with their history. I took a bus ride on Metro one time from Hollywood. This is like a couple weeks ago. And on the way back, this is like Sunday morning, about 4 or 5 in the morning, getting back to Santa Monica, which is nice, the west side of L.A. by the ocean. And so as I'm going along, all the African-American people that are on there were homeless, and they're just basically street bums. And all the Hispanics getting on the bus were people going to work, so they had like little white shirts on, kind of like you know, waiters and waitresses and you know, people who clean houses and things. They're all really nice clothes, everything, and all the brothers who kept getting on the bus were just, I mean, they smelled of urine and vomit and everything, and it was just, it was, I mean, it was one of those things where if you grow up with that every day, barriers come up, and suddenly you're looking at someone just because of the color of skin, when it's really not that issue. It could be anything. So say you're molested by someone who's...
It could have just been a coincidence.
Well,
of Mexicans who are homeless probably don't take the bus.
They probably don't, but kind of in L.A., and I guess every town's, you know, different. I'm sure in Mexico there's homeless people that smell. But just if you go to Skid Row... In L.A., it's predominantly black, and even though black is African-Americans 10% of the population, you know, you go to Skid Row, it's probably 60-70% black. Now, I'm just, you know, throwing a number. I haven't done a survey, but I've been out there,
well,
you know.
In L.A., with the diversity, you know, I'm agreeing with what you're saying, but it could have just been the direction of the bus, because when I used to take the bus from East Hollywood to Beverly Hills, there were a lot of domestic workers who were Latino who were headed to Beverly Hills to work in fancy houses.
Right, so they had to work. You know, they've got to be on time. They can't smell. They've got to, you know, be shower and clothes. And, you know, I mean, they're basically, they're ready for work. And what I'm saying is there's just on the west side in Santa Monica, it attracts a lot of minority African-American homeless people. And so, but the point being is it's just the reference point. You know, if you lived in an upscale black community, and say all the white redneck people or trailer park trash people you encountered, if that was your experience, then you might look down on white people. So I think it maybe has to do more with either experiences or even the historical preferences. You know, I think Bob's looking kind of from a civilization angle, just the decline of an empire. Usually, you know, several things happen. One of them is the moral compass just goes out to nothing. And part of that is when the culture goes homosexual and it stops being family-oriented, stops being a moralistic country. When you start losing your morals, these are concepts, these are principles or building blocks of your culture, and when those things erode, the culture usually fails. So I think
well,
you're looking at the historian.
That's a rational point, and I agree with that premise. I guess what you it is based on perspective, and I think like you, when you mentioned your story the other night in San Jose, I think Bob had a similar negative experience like that.
Right. I can tell you this, at 13 years old, having a, you know, late 30s, early 40s male try to put his hand down your pants and hold on to whatever you want to call it. Afterwards, you know, being a young man and kind of naive and innocent, I did feel rage. to the point of, like, I wanted to, like, find him and just, you know, punch his face, right? It just for a second. You know, it wasn't like the rest of my life I had this mission. But just in
well,
that moment.
Well, you probably literally had to run from him.
Because you kind of feel violated, you know, and it was one of those things I just kept saying. Fortunately, I was old enough. It wasn't like I was 8 or 9. You know, I was physically was old enough to either outrun him or punch him, and get away if it was came down to a physical situation. And he wasn't a very athletic, male. But the point is,
I did want to say that most gay people are not criminals.
Oh yeah, no. In fact, it has. I mean, whether you're gay or not, you know, you can be very moralistic in other areas. You could be nice. You could be friendly. I mean, you could be an a-hole. You know, it doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. So sometimes people confuse that, and we think because you're gay, you have to be a certain way. No, I'm with you on that. I just think what you're talking about, though, is there's an agenda.
Basically, the reason I brought it up is just because we do have a radio network. And in modern times, if someone was listening to the archives, someone could translate it into hate speech. But Bob didn't really clarify the reason why he said it.
Oh, yeah.
You're a little more articulate on your points. And I wanted to tell the audience that my feeling was that even as middle-aged Christian or whatever I want to call myself, my church is one of the only two in northern Minnesota that supports gay rights, and I just happened to join the church because of proximity. I didn't know that until after I joined the church. But
right.
Basically, I'm kind of neutral on the subject because I had to be when Ernest was part of our network, and he's a big mouthpiece for gay rights. So I didn't really feel like I wanted to... what he would say I would be denying him his human rights of some sort, even though there were certain things that I disagreed with him.
Right, and I think we talk differently in different groups of people. If we're in a group of, like, totally, call it anti-gay, or people are very straight and very overly moralistic, you can go, oh, you know, hey, our culture's going downhill, and, you know, it's the homosexuality and loose... sexual morals is destroying our country, and everyone go, yeah. But if you're talking to a gay person, that's not necessarily going to translate well. They're going to go, hey, you're racist, or you're bigoted, or you're narrow-minded, or you're a hater, or, you know, you're the cause of all this problems in the world, and there's so much division. So, it just depends the context of the situation. And similar to, like, when the president, when he talks to white people, he talks very... very, you know, educated.
He's actually even a little too cerebral when he's talking to black people. Cause,
but then sometimes if he's in front of a church...
That March on Selma that Obama did, that was one of the first times that he's directly addressed an all-black audience, practically. I mean, there were other people there, too, but...
Right. And they've done, you know, news clips, snippets where he's talked to a predominantly black kind of, you know, call it a Baptist style of church, and he starts talking with y'all and, you know, this and that. And
Ebonics, yeah.
Yeah, he starts...
So let me just make one
more
comment.
But there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to jump into the Peshmerga, and there's one reason why. But I just want to mention one last comment. When I remember Ernest... I did try to have rational debates with him about homosexuality. He said Sodom and Gomorrah wasn't burned down because there was homosexuals. They were burned down because there was not one righteous man. Like, he always, his favorite word is cherry pick. And he would cherry pick elements out of the Bible and suit them for his mental cognition, what he wanted
right.
to see and hear. So,
I think you're going to see a lot of backpedaling in churches, and, you know, whether and not just Christian, but Jewish, pretty much any faith-based religion that has morals regarding sexuality, they're going to be backpedaling because this is becoming an issue now where everyone's saying you've got to accept gays, you have to give equal rights, and you have to treat them with, you know, total, not just respect, but total rights, and as being, as
and
having
I do
privileges.
For the most part, and I don't challenge people on a public scale, but if someone wants to ask me what the Bible says, I will tell them.
Right. Well, also, too, here's another thing, and that is in society and culture, we do choose, you know, we have the preference of what we want our society to be when we vote. You know, if we want to have, example, polygamy as a culture, and we all vote on it, you know, there's certain parts of the country where people practice it, and they go, well, why do they do that? Because they got together, and they hang out in this community. And, you know, years ago, it's like certain...
I do have a point regarding that. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, right now it's 2:15 Central Time. When it hits 2:20, we're going to have to switch to the Persh Mega because that's a headliner. But
yes.
I was watching another documentary on David Koresh because I'm still doing that online series. You know, I'm on part 4 this week on a fictional account. It's actually a true account of what happened, but I put in two fictional detectives. So I was watching this documentary, and there was a testifying before Congress after the Waco siege, after the ATF failed and the Branch Davidians burned the place down. And there was a girl who was 15 years old or so testifying that David Koresh had fondled her at age 10, 11, or 12. I think it was 10.
Mercy.
And then... somebody challenged her truthfulness right on the floor of the Congress hearings, and they said, I overheard one person say even your mother didn't believe you. Well, anyways, when the ATF went in there, they first went to verify if they were making legal gun sales, and the Department of Social Services had already done an investigation to see if Koresh was sleeping with younger kids. But they couldn't find any proof because they, like three or four of the top men in the group shielded information to protect Koresh. So they embarrassed this girl, this young girl on the congressional floor, and tried to make her look like a liar. They wouldn't. She finished her testimony, and then somebody challenged it. I'm not really sure why, because there was other members of the group there. But basically, what I'm trying to say is your point that even when the government takes on things like that Warren Jeffers, that Utah Mormon who slept with young girls, and they had him remove children from that place, it was further west than Texas, that the government doesn't always have a handle on things like that, and they can't always regulate moral codes, just like they can't regulate online prostitution.
Right. I just think as a culture, we can set our moral compass and say these are the parameters of the game. This is how we're going to rule, and this is what we want in our society. And we all come together and agree on that. What's happening now is that a small percentage, you know, whether it's 1 or 3%, is that are gay and are very upset. They're getting legal. They're getting lawyers, and they're fighting through the legal system. And they're trying to control what the majority of us, I mean, the majority of people, if you set them in a corner and say, well, do you want gay rights? They'd say, well, okay, I guess they should have rights. But if they were to say, do you want your son or daughter to be gay? They would say, not really, you know, no. Or even like tonight, hey, you want to cross, change teams and switch, you know, and let's have a little orgy going on. They'd be like, no, I'm out. It's like they really don't want that as a society. And when it comes to vote in every state, it's always the majority wants to have heterosexual, you know, marriages and family. But it goes back to Supreme Court, they keep overturning it. And why is it being appealed? Because it's a couple, like 5% or 3% of the population is fighting against it. So it's controlling what all of us, you know,
I think
what society.
It just depends on the state, you know. It's just like I don't want to talk about gay rights on every show, but
right.
Alabama had a courthouse, and there were the Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse, and the U.S. Justice Department or some higher upper Supreme Court made them tear it down, and stuff like that. And it just depends on which part of the country you're dealing with as far as gay rights. There's
right.
many different stratified levels. And some things go through and other things don't. But, you know, anyways, I think we should switch to our other topic.
Right, right.
I'm not trying to cut you off, but...
oh, no.
It's just that we pretty much hashed this all out with the Bruce Jenner thing and stuff. So what I was trying to say earlier before you joined the show is the reason I brought up the Peshmerga tonight, which is I think it might be an Arabic word, but it means those who face death. It's actually a group of grounded fighters that have been around since the late 1800s, and they've had it was more like a tribal warfare thing back in those days. But then the Ottoman Empire dissolved, and then the Kurdish army became part of northern Iraq, Kurdistan, Iran, and Turkey. The Kurds have always been kind of like the Jews. They've been a disliked minority. Well, in 1988, Saddam Hussein attacked them with chemical warfare because they weren't totally compliant. And then they were involved in World War II back in the day, defending themselves. But the main thing is now they're the only main army up there in northern Iraq that are trying to handle ISIS. And because Congress is taking their time trying to get approval for different kinds of funding there, whether we're going to be sending armaments or military trainers, they've pretty much been on their own fighting in places like Tikrit and Mosul. And they're also losing casualties. But one of the main reasons the U.S. doesn't want to directly fund them is because the good old country of Iran is helping them. And because we're Iran's political enemy, now Iran is doing something noble to help the world, and they're not being recognized because the U.S. doesn't want to acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering what your opinion on that is.
Well, from what I understand, they're kind of, you know, as far as historically, they've been nomadic people, tent people, or tent dwellers. So, and they are a minority in every country they're at. So, it's kind of hard to gain support. It's kind of almost like, I wouldn't call them homeless, but, you know, it's kind of like people that, like David Koresh, you know, where you got this kind of commune type of, you know, people, you know, living out in the woods, doing their thing, traveling
along.
Well,
you know what? They're much more established than they were, like, around World War II, because
right.
Remember when we entered Iraq? First we entered the Gulf War, then we entered in 2003. By 2004, the Kurds had control of their northern Iraq. They established their own government. They were autonomous from Baghdad.
Right.
They were pretty much left to fend for themselves, but they didn't need it because all they wanted was autonomy to begin with. So they did start out as nomadic and tribal, and even if you look at some of the pictures of the fighters nowadays, they kind of look like herdsmen and stuff. But
right.
Kurdistan is part of Russia.
Right.
You know,
kind of like the history or the past of a person kind of taints, you know, their future. So I guess what I'm saying, like a lot of the people that were at Woodstock or they lived in communes, they got jobs at IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Apple, and so forth. They grew up, you know, and now they're responsible citizens and they're influential or they're yuppies. But, you know, 30 years ago they were smoking pot and having, you know, tie-dyed shirts. So what I'm saying is, culturally, they may have advanced and moved forward, but I'm just saying there's a past history. They're not highly regarded, I guess is what I'm saying, they're not respected among
respect them, and I'll explain why. Back when I remember the Iran-Iraq war?
Yes.
Well, the Kurds, some of the Kurds in northern Iraq aligned with Iran because they were a punished minority, and they were more culturally and religiously attached to the Iranian disenfranchised groups than the Iraqi loyalty, and Saddam Hussein severely punished them. But I want to talk for a minute about Kurdistan. It was a roughly defined geocultural area where with a predominant Kurd population. But it was part of Russia, just like those other countries that formed around there at the time, like Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, where James, my friend, was from, and which is not a Kurdish country, by the way. But a lot of those Stan countries were formed in 1989 after the Russian Empire fell. Well, some Kurdish national organizations sought to create an independent state, which included some of those boundaries near Turkey and stuff. So I don't know. They weren't that well liked by Saddam Hussein and the Sunnis, who used to be the elite. But they weren't like just low lifes. They were just people who were persecuted.
Right. No, and in fact, you know, maybe it's just, you know, in our culture, maybe just the way that it sounds, Kurds. I don't know. It just doesn't have a powerful ring to it. Like Persian or, you know, something of that nature. But I think part of what happens is we respect money, we respect technology and knowledge, and I think they're more people of the land, and I think, which is actually good. You know, we almost, kind of like Indians, you know, we despise that. It's like we despise people who are naturalists. We think that, you know, technology and money and power and fame is the key to life, and it's not. I mean, you get all that stuff, and then you realize that we're very disruptive to our world. So actually, in a certain way, yeah, I like them too. I like how
they
are.
Haven't had it easy, because even Turkey, which has a Kurdish minority population, they inhabited areas of an area called Anatolia, and they had a long-running separatist battle or conflict where thousands of lives were lost. And they weren't treated well by the Turks either. But in 1983, when Kurdistan became more established, a guerrilla warfare took place in the 80s and 90s in which much of their countryside was evacuated. Thousands of villages were destroyed and executions were taking place. So I think they've been on their guard for over a century.
Mm-hmm. No, are
and my,
they...
my only main point is that here we find the potential of having Iran and the U.S. on the same side in a certain battle, because nobody really wants ISIS around, and what is the U.S. going to do about it? Are they going to play games, or are they going to help, you know, are they going to align with Iran to dissolve the ISIS?
Well, here's a question: with Kurds, are they aligned with the Soviets as far as getting, you know, money or arms and things like that?
You know, the thing is I'll be honest, I don't know that much about Kurdistan, but they have been a loose confederation with northern Iraq for years. Let me just look this up quick. They're located in the Zagros Mountains in Upper Mesopotamia, which is, I guess, northern Iraq, and part of Syria, which has also been having numerous problems. I don't know. Russia, I don't think Russia controls part of them, but Russia controls some of, you know, like those places like Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan that have large oil reserves. I think there is... those countries are quite independent now, but I'm sure Russia has a hand in it because it used to be their country.
Wow.
So
yeah,
I don't have
like
all
a lot
the
of
answers for, I don't have the answer for that one, John. I'd have to look
it
up.
It looks like a lot of the culture has villages. They have simple houses made of mud. So it's a kind of simple culture, and they're stuck in this situation with ISIS. Oh, mercy. I mean, I guess... you know, no matter what they believe, we're kind of like anyone who can line up and is in a position to fight them is a good thing. You know, I just sometimes though it's kind of war can make the strangest of bedfellows. You know,
to make things less confusing, though, Kurds occupy part of Syria, Turkey, northern Iraq, and Iran. And I'm looking on this thing in Wikipedia. There's over 20 cities with over 100,000 Kurds in them. Mm-hmm. So,
and the majority of Kurds are Sunni Muslim and with very Islamic.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I just know that Saddam Hussein didn't like them, and part of it was probably because of their independent spirit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some Christians within it, too, but the majority, it looks like it's Islamic. That's interesting.
I think the reason Pat Robertson decided to highlight them on his show, which, you know, he must be up in his upper 80s by now, but I think it's because there are some Kurdish Christians, and they're not getting much help from the international community, and because they're geographically located in an area where ISIS is really fighting strongly. They just kind of happen to be a victim of time and circumstance.
Interesting.
So, I just wanted to bring that up. We can talk. Now we have 15 minutes left. We can transfer into just free talk since it's the middle of the night. And sometimes we get interesting members of the public. We're past the mark, though, where people can call in and talk. They can
still
listen,
though. So we
can't
get any prank calls right now? Oh, man. I was living
for
that.
No, but after the show, I can always check how many live listens there were.
Oh, cool.
So what kind of day did you have today?
Yeah, it was a good day. I've been kind of tripping a little bit on. I saw a movie that was released a couple of years back. James Franco starred in. It was called 127. It's a true story of a guy who's, and I'd heard this story before. He was hiking through the Utah mountains, slipped through a crevice, and a boulder fell down along with him, 800-pound boulder, and it pinned his hand.
Oh, God.
And he was stuck there for 3 or 4 days, and he made the stupid mistake of, because he was such a, as he called himself, a hard freaking hero, except he didn't use the word freaking, but basically he didn't tell anyone where he was at. So no one knew that was going to go and rescue him, because he didn't tell anyone he was gone. And after about 3 or 4 days, he came to the conclusion he's just going to have to cut off his arm to get out of there and live. And you know, he actually did that. He made a tourniquet, cut off his arm. It's a long story, but the point
God,
is,
I can't handle it.
But the point is, he made it to safety, and he actually is a motivational speaker. And one of the things he talks about was that he had a destiny. He had a date with that boulder to meet. Like, they were on an alignment. And a lot of times, I guess the point I'm making is that we have a lot of things that happen in our life that we think are accidental, and maybe they are. But then again, maybe they're not. you know, sometimes, you know, example, we go, oh, well, there was a car accident, and, you know, this car slammed into the wall and hit someone. It was, an innocent bystander, totally accidental. It's like, well, not totally accidental. It's like the car was going a certain path, a certain velocity, hit a certain angle, and that propelled it right into the path of someone who was in that same direction. And in a way,
his situation could have been interpreted two ways, though. One, he could have been an experienced rock climber, but two, he may have not taken enough precautions. He might have been haughty within his own talent, or that could be one interpretation. But I think it is rather humbling that he chose to perceive it as a date with destiny, because the fact of the matter is, I don't think most people would be that humble or grateful and interpret it that way.
Well, you know, it made him realize the way he was living his life was destining him to be alone or to be. He was challenging death, you know, going up cliffs and mountains and hiking and doing stuff and by himself. And I guess that's kind of the point I was trying to make, is there's things that a lot of times, like, someone called me up and said, oh, I'm late, I'm so sorry. And I said, you know, you're exactly where you need to be right now. And that changes your whole perspective. Because instead of being frustrated and upset and, oh, it's her fault I'm late, it's this, you know, person's fault that I'm divorced, it's this other situation, it's like, no, these things happen specifically based, and this is what he was saying.
So did
is,
the man learn how to adapt without an arm, or did he get like a false arm?
He got a prosthesis, and he acted kind of like a hook thing. He looks kind of like Robo mountain climber. And the other thing is, he actually, after that, he continued on to do like 14 or 15 of the most steepest climbs, you know, in his area, and got on this list of like, you know, kind of like the Hall of Fame of mountain climbers in the particular field he was in. But what he was saying is that we make these choices that bring us to these decisions, to these situations. And life is life and death drama, but every move we make contributes into that. It's not just accidental, you know, the things that happen, the divorce, the bankruptcy, losing your job, you know, the diet that you eat that causes the health problems that you encounter. And so it's a kind of a responsible way of dealing with your life, and it helps you to get some perspective. So you're not frustrated and just going, why did this happen to me? Well, there's a lot of reasons, you know, and some of it's just the way you respond to it.
Did you say that he went on many more mountain walks after that?
Yes. However, the point is he made to that is he always calls and lets people know where he's going. You know,
well,
that
by
was
the way,
key.
Is he a Christian?
No, I was trying to look that up. It doesn't seem that if he is, he's a closet one because he doesn't seem to acknowledge like, oh, I you know, it got me close to God or I prayed or anything like that. It was more kind of almost atheistic in the sense of he looked at the boulder when he cut his arm off and it fell to the ground. And he looked at it and he said, thank you to the rock. It's like, you've altered my life. Because he had 3 or 4 days to think about his life. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, he's in pain. He's sitting there thinking, you know, I should have called my mom. Oh, that person I broke up with. Oh, the things I didn't say to so-and-so. You know, the choices
well,
I didn't make.
He still had to walk probably 5 or 10 miles back to where he was with
he had to scale
no
down.
Arm.
He had some rope because he was prepared for you know, to climb this thing. So he had to scale down the sheer face of a cliff.
With no arm?
With one arm.
Been free. You know, that guy is so strong. I don't know how that person could really do that.
Right, he lost about 25% of
humble.
His blood. Right, it was. And when people found him, you can imagine it's like because he ran down some people. He saw some people going by, and he was yelling to them, and they were so desolate. These people couldn't call for help because they were out of cell range. So they had, you know. So he's walking
did they
along.
They give him a ride at least.
Oh well, they were hikers too, you know, adventurers. So he was telling them. They were trying to tell him, hey, you need to lay down and just relax. He's like, no, we got to keep going. We cannot stop. You know, I'm going to die here. So he told him, run ahead of me. Just go, you know. Leave one behind, but send the others ahead. And they airlifted him out, and he survived. But it was just a life-changing experience. You know, he got married, has a kid, and kind of...
He has a child.
Has a kid, yeah. And he's got a... I think the kid was born about 2 or 3 years ago. They did a movie about his life, and now he talks and speaks all over the country. His name is, starts with an A. I always want to say Arlo. No, it's
Aaron.
Aaron Ratliff, I believe. And it's called, James Franco played him in the movie called 127.
127 days. I looked up the picture.
Basically 127 hours. It's about 4 or 5
I'm
days.
Sorry.
He would have been,
I meant to say 127 hours.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been around too long if it was 127 days. but it's possible if he had a little food and water. But no, it's
well,
true.
I just you know, I don't know. I've been very emotional lately. I went to the doctor today and. There was the man there today, I'm 54, and he was probably like 35, and he was in a wheelchair with his head back a little. He could barely breathe. He had an oxygen mask on. He had a dog in his lap. He looked like he was on death's door.
Mercy.
And, I mean, people have to go through terminal illnesses, and they might be in that kind of state for a year.
Oh, yeah.
And here I was just bitching because I had a... it was my day off and I had to spend 30 minutes at the doctor.
It makes us, you know, very grateful and very appreciative. Oh, by the way, the guy's name is Aaron Ralston. Aaron Ralston.
Okay, I'll look his picture up. So what kind of person was he? Did you see the whole movie or just read the article?
I did. At first I thought, you know, because, you know, Slick, my musical brother, likes to tape all these fishing network stuff. It's always, he's taping them every day, right? So sometimes I'll be watching something, and if he tapes more than two events, it will override what you're watching. So I might be watching a movie, and suddenly I see the timer goes on, and it gives you like 2 minutes or a minute and a half before it gets, you know, the taping starts. So it's kind of like this countdown, like, oh boy, you know, we've just been intercepted by the recorder. And it's like I have, you know, 90 seconds to see whatever I want to see. It's going to get taken over by the, you know, the recording. And so I thought, oh, it's going to be one of these fishing, you know, it was on the fishing network, and I thought, I don't really want to watch fishing stuff. But it's like, hey, this is kind of a cool movie. And the reason I brought it up is because he basically was a survivalist. He decided he was going to do whatever it takes to live. He ran out of water after about the third day, so the last 2 days he had to drink his own urine. And, I mean, you talk about...
Oh,
you know,
God. First he loses an arm, then he can't even drink water.
He's got to survive on that. And, you know, think about that. You know, it's like, how determined... Oh, and here's the other thing. He wanted to cut his arm off because, I mean, he realized he wanted to live. But the problem was the knife he had wasn't sharp enough to cut the arm. So he figured he'd have to break the bone there. So he used the angle of the boulder to break, you know, and it took several times. And so because he couldn't cut through a bone. So he had to break his arm. And then when he's sawing through, he said actually the hardest part was the nerves. When he got to the nerves, it was like fire just shooting through his arm. So he had to get to, there's like a cluster of nerves in the center there. He had to cut through two arteries. He had a really good tourniquet on, but it was cutting the nerves that was really the hardest. And the point of what I make of that is, you know, what could you have done? You know, would you have survived? I don't think most people could do it. I don't think, you know, most people would have had the intensity.
That's what I'm saying. How could anyone be that mentally strong to have to endure that?
Right. And it makes me wonder, it's like, you know,
wow.
He
had faith it was going to pull off.
And he was, you know, a certain, your survival instincts do kick in. And you start, you know, I mean, like a couple weeks ago, yeah, I had a car hit me, well, maybe over a month ago, but, you know, hit me if I flew off and I jumped up and off we go. And it wasn't just that I got hit, it was the fact that while I was getting hit, I wasn't freaking out. I didn't have my heart go up to 160. You know, it was just like, okay, here comes a car. Let's see what happens here. It was kind of like third person. Really weird. It's like, okay, let's see if we can survive this one.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things in dog sitting and, you know, taking care of the dog. It's like, I think I could handle anything, you know. Whereas before, it would be a lot harder. But no, I think I can deal with it.
Yeah, well, look what you're having to do. It's just, I don't have it as rough as you right now. I have a well-running car, but I did have days where I would have to bike back and forth to Macy's in my mid-40s, or late 40s. Because I sold my car to work for Al Franken. When I came back, I didn't have a car.
One thing, though, but that you endure that, I don't know how well I would do, and that is cold. You know, once it gets below freezing, which is 32 degrees, I really have a hard time moving. I just do. So,
well, the month of February, it didn't get above 13 degrees. I think one day it got up to 20.
Yeah, see, that might be my Achilles heel. That might just do me in right there.
Well,
anything
at least
else
you have a
voluntarily with.
Choice about where you have to live. Like, now I'm stuck here till Lauren graduates.
Yeah, see, I think I could do the drinking, the urine thing. I think I could even break my arm and cut it off. But you put me in under 32 degrees, I think I'm done.
Well, I think I'd rather keep my arm and freeze. Well, we have 1 minute left. Where are we following tonight? You say the final thought.
Follow the truth wherever it leads you, but be